Hello everyone, it's June 23rd, 2015. We have such an exciting show today because we have Fireflies. I wonder if they call themselves that. To be precise, we have four awesome engineers from Firefly Space Systems. So let's get on with the show. Okay, liftoff. And we've cleared the tower. Welcome to episode number 15 of the Orbital Mechanics Podcast. I'm David.
I'm Ben.
Hey, as we record this, it is Father's Day. So have you called your father yet?
Or
did you forget it completely? Just say no. That's okay.
I sent him a present. I haven't called him.
I'm going to call my dad later on. So we have to get this podcast out of the way so I can call him. Happy Father's Day, Dad, if you're listening. I don't know if he really does or not. Well, let's move on to some spaceflight news. The top of the list here, I think I put this one in first. So in no particular order, I did want to talk about the low density supersonic decelerator. This is, I think it's pretty cool. We had discussed it a while back. Or had we? I don't remember.
Yeah, well, this one actually flew the day that we released our last episode. So this is from about as far back as you can go.
Yeah, so it's about 2 weeks old, but finally it flew out of the North Pacific Missile Range or whatever it's called out on the west coast of Kauai. Yeah.
Not White Sands.
I'm 90% sure it's Barking Sands.
Oh, yeah, sorry. No. It's different from Barking Sands. White Sands is in the American Southwest.
Yes.
In like New Mexico or something. No, Barking Sands is on Hawaii, but it's in a different part of the island, I think.
Well, I'm looking at it right now. Yeah, so it is on the west coast of Kauai, which is like the smaller island, the one where I used to live. But it's on the west coast of that island. So, yeah, it's basically
isn't
the northern
Pacific Missile Range also on the west coast?
Yeah.
Are they the same? I thought they were different.
I think they're the same. Well, if they're not the same, they're right next to each other.
Okay.
They're, you know, it's basically all part of the same facility. Yeah, I guess Barking Sands is sort of like the name of the beach itself. And there's also a Barking Sands airport as well, which I guess is just for like military aircraft. No one ever lands there. There's only one actual airport that's on the island. Anyway, yeah, so Barking Sands, west coast of Kauai, they launched the low-density supersonic decelerator, which is this interesting device that is being developed for the purposes of essentially landing heavier payloads on Mars. And I guess it might have other applications as well, but I was doing some reading on it, and I think it's a pretty novel concept. What really interests me about it is that, so as it stands right now, you can land maximum about, well, something like the Mars Curiosity rover on Mars, which I think was about 1 metric ton. I think it was right around there. That's the absolute maximum amount. But if you want to put any heavier payloads down, you just can't do it for a variety of reasons, mostly because Mars doesn't have much of an atmosphere, so you can't use parachutes.
Yeah, that's the big reason. Yeah, so just for reference, for crewed missions, we're talking about 50 to 100 tons per, you know, per payload package on the ground. Like, that's the kind of area that we want to be shooting for. So 1 ton seems like a lot, but it's really not a lot.
I mean, do you think that it could be done without such a device at all? And if you just use, I guess, you know, propulsive landing, which is what SpaceX wants to do, but they can't land 100 tons on Mars, at least not yet.
Well, they can't land anything on Mars right now.
Anything. Well, I mean, yeah, good point. I meant with existing technology, like say you could land a Dragon 2 spacecraft on Mars, I would imagine wouldn't be too hard. That's what that is designed to do. But anything larger than that, it becomes a bit of a problem because you have to slow down significantly, and the atmosphere doesn't provide enough of a slowdown, unless you can, you know, increase the volume without the weight or without increasing the weight of the spacecraft, which is exactly what this low density supersonic decelerator does. So, but yeah, 100 tons. So we're nowhere near that now. But this particular vehicle is a concept really more than anything. It's going to be the actual working version of it is going to be much bigger. I think something, I don't remember, like 10 meters across, something like that.
They've tested those 10 meter ones on the, or they've tested a 10 meter one on the ground. But I don't know. I don't know if they're actually aiming towards a particular vehicle or if they're just learning how to use this technology.
Yeah, I don't think they're aiming towards the vehicle right now. At the moment, they just attach a little engine to it, you know, and that's basically just to get it up to a certain height, specifically about 180,000 feet. And at that point, it's going about Mach 4, and then it begins to descend, and the supersonic decelerator inflates, thereby increasing the volume, which, you know, is what helps slow it down.
Well, before you go any farther, I'm sure that everybody knows this already, but it's worth pointing out that the reason that we are flying LDSD so high up in the atmosphere is because it's basically a Martian atmosphere.
Right, exactly.
You know, it's a different composition, but you have something that's very, very similar. And I think it's so cool that you can do that. This is something that you'd want to test on Mars, but since we can't get to Mars very easily, let's just do it in our own atmosphere and send it up really high. That's super cool.
That's the whole idea, and that's why you have to go up to about 180,000 feet, because at that altitude, that's about what Martian atmosphere is like, which is less than 1% of what it is on Earth. I don't remember the exact number, but it's very, very thin.
Yeah, it's in that area.
Yeah, it's an incredibly thin atmosphere. And so they want to... So, I'm thinking if you use this, it would still need to be used in combination with something like the, you know, propulsive landing device that was used to land the Mars Curiosity rover.
Or, an airbag tumble vehicle, you know. Like,
yeah.
Like Spirit and Opportunity, you know.
But if you're going to be landing something with this device, I'm assuming it's going to be about 2 tons or more. And can you do that with an airbag device? I mean, I guess you could, but that doesn't sound very elegant.
Like, yeah, we haven't done it yet. And yeah, that's not something you can put people in or delicate equipment in. But, you know, you're right. This isn't enough. And certainly the sizes that we just tested aren't enough. But, you know, we're kind of moving in the right direction, and it's just one more weapon in our arsenal is the way I like to think about it.
It's incredible how difficult it is to put significant amount of payload down on Mars. I mean, never mind getting there in the first place. Sure, that's hard enough. But just getting something down on the surface, it really is tricky, because you can't do it you can't do it in airplane fashion, because there's not enough atmosphere and there's no runways. And you can't use parachutes either. But at the same time, you have to deal with the atmosphere, because it is just thick enough to be a problem, but you can't really use it to slow yourself down. I mean, like, the whole idea of this technology is that you do use it, but it doesn't help a whole lot. Yeah, it's a tricky thing. It just highlights how difficult it is to land things on Mars, and that's kind of why I wanted to mention it and why I find it interesting, because this technology, in combination with other things, is going to be the only way that you're ever going to put anything of a significant mass down on the surface. It's just way more difficult than anyone realizes, I think, or at least most, you know, the common space fan perhaps realizes. Tricky landing on Mars.
Yeah. So LDSD brought in a lot of data, just like its predecessor. But I don't think we mentioned that the parachute again did not survive.
Yeah, it keeps on snapping.
Oh, yeah. This one looked like it fared a little better. It's hard to tell from the, low res image, or, you know, the low res video that they were streaming mm-hmm. off of the spacecraft. But yeah, it looked like it lasted, you know, a fraction of a second longer, but the parachute still got torn to pieces, and the control room kind of, there was this collective, oh, as it tore apart. But again, this is literally the best data we've ever had on supersonic parachutes. We did studies on supersonic parachutes back in the 60s or 70s, I believe, and the video was so low resolution that it was nothing compared to what we're getting now. So even though this is, you know, a destroyed parachute, it's still a successful test. We still got good data back.
Yeah, the test overall was successful, although they're going to need to fix the parachute problem. That's going to be essential for actually putting things on Mars.
Well, we've built parachutes that have flown to Mars.
Right.
We're talking about big parachutes, I think. I think that's the difference.
Well, right. The whole idea is that, yeah, it's going to need to be bigger, and I think it's going to be deploying at maybe a slightly faster speed. I don't know. How fast was the Mars Curiosity rover going when it deployed that drogue chute? I mean, it was still supersonic, right?
Well, yeah, it must have been supersonic, because it had only used, you know, a small aero shell to decelerate. So very, very, very fast. But also, you know, it had a secondary landing system, basically. It could slow itself down with rockets, so.
Yeah. Did you see any videos on how they test these parachutes? Because it's really tricky. The best way is to actually launch it on a rocket and then, you know, have it deploy. But as far as developing it, they have to attach it to a kind of a ground-based rocket sled. And then they just pull it along.
With a big pulley, yeah. So the parachute's going down and the rocket sled's going 90 degrees along the ground. Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, but in order to even set that up, you have to have a helicopter which actually holds the parachute up before it gets yanked away by the rocket sled. It's very difficult. I mean, I had no idea that it could be so difficult just to test a parachute.
Well, and even when you're doing that, you're doing supersonic at what, like 380 miles an hour? That's nothing compared to supersonic higher up in the atmosphere.
Well, at ground level, supersonic is 700 and something miles per hour.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm thinking meters per second.
Okay.
Cause that's what I'm thinking now. But I mean, it's very slow. Supersonic speeds close to the ground are very, very, very slow compared to supersonic speeds higher up in the atmosphere. So it's easier for a parachute to do its job when you've got more air that's moving slower than less air that's moving faster. So all this testing is really tough.
Most definitely. All right. Do you want to move on to the next topic?
Yeah, this next topic really, really excites me.
Yeah, this one, this is all in the news. Philae woke up.
Yeah. So Philae landed on Churyumov of Gerasimenko just before we started this show, right? I mean, like just before our first episode?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was, yeah, it's been around. I mean, the first I'd heard of it, because I guess I wasn't following things that closely before then. But yeah, it was right around our first episode.
I don't remember if we covered it in our first episode. I'm going to look it up, actually, because I'm curious. But, you know, Philae's kind of been asleep while we've been doing this entire show. And, you know, we've kind of been waiting and hoping. And we'd actually entered a point where it was becoming less and less likely that it would wake up as time went on. And that kind of period started a few weeks ago.
Is that just because the more time that it goes without waking up, more systems shut down or freeze over and then they just can't be rebooted?
Yeah, possibly. I think the bigger issue was just that it would never get sun because we didn't know exactly where it was. We had seen photos and we could see that it was in the shadow of a cliff. But that didn't tell us too much. And so we hoped that the sun would shine on it. And I think we just got to a point where if the sun hasn't already shone on it, it's probably not going to until it's too late, you know.
Well, the good news is that I think it hasn't quite yet reached its perihelion. I think that's going to be in mid-August or somewhere around there. So there's still a couple months left. So it's still getting closer to the sun. Not that makes as much of a difference as, you know, the angle at which it's facing the sun, which I'm not sure about what that is, but it's getting just enough light at this point. So it has woken back up.
Okay. So I switched back to our episode one show notes and we didn't talk about Philae, but it's interesting to me that we did talk about SpinSat, which is that round satellite with the electric solid fuel. And we talked about that in our first show. And that recently they officially ended the experiment and they sent down some bits and bobs like handles and a wrench and stuff on Dragon. Somebody had said that they actually returned the satellite itself, and that's not true. But yeah, it's kind of cool that happened way back at our first show. It's kind of a trip down memory lane there. Yeah, so I wanted to just summarize Philae's plight real quick. Everybody who listens to the show should be familiar with this, but it's worth mentioning just in case. Philae had a couple of failures, including a thruster that sits on top of its head that was supposed to ignite and press it into the comet to keep it from bouncing. And they knew that that wasn't going to be able to fire, or they had a pretty good idea that it wasn't going to. They'd had issues before. But what they didn't expect was that the drills on the end of its three legs weren't going to fire, and those didn't either. So it bounced up once and then landed and bounced a second time and finally landed a third time. ESA said that it was, you know, that the lander had successfully landed three times and they were really spinny and happy about that, which I thought was kind of cool. But anyway, when it landed with one leg in the air. It landed with most of its panels facing away from the sun. And like I said before, it landed in the shadow of a cliff. So as soon as the scientists realized that it was down on the ground and it wasn't moving and that it was having issues with power, they started working as fast as they could, and they got every single one of its science experiments deployed, and they collected data from a great number of those experiments. But they didn't get all the data because the craft decided to shut down and go to sleep and preserve its power in case it got sunlight later, which is, you know, what you want to happen. And so it kind of went to sleep, and everybody went, oh, okay, cool. That's, you know, that's that. We got a lot of data from it, but hopefully we'll see it again, but we're not going to expect it to. Then a couple of weeks ago, the Rosetta team started talking about the end of life of the orbiter, and they decided that they were going to land Rosetta on the comet, and not only were they going to land Rosetta, but they were going to land it right next to Philae, or as close as they could get, purely for sentimental reasons, which I think is really cool. I'm glad that ESA is willing to admit that they're sentimental.
Well, how are they going to... Let me move on to another thing that I just recently found out, which is exactly how Rosetta is going to be orbiting, or has been orbiting the comet. It's not actually in orbit. It's basically just making a series of burns, which keeps it sort of in the vicinity of the comet. So how are they planning on landing? Are they just going to do a burn in that general direction and then just let it softly fall?
Yeah, I think they're basically going to do a rendezvous with the comet. We talked, like, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 shows ago, we talked about how Churiguri, the comet, is now sending out so much water gas that it actually pushes Rosetta away faster than its gravity can pull it in. So I imagine they might have to do a little bit of thrusting down towards the comet until they get close enough that the gravity is strong. But yeah, I mean, the gravity is so weak that they can basically just move in the right direction and they'll just kind of floof down on the surface. That's probably what they're going to be doing. And I don't know. We'll find out. But honestly, it's not going to be like landing on the moon. It's going to be, you know, let's get as close to the comet as we can. And that's really what constitutes a landing in this case.
Yeah, it's almost more of a, well, I don't know how much gravity it has. I mean, it's still enough, obviously, to hold something to it. But the whole comet, it's what, about 4 kilometers from end to end at its widest point, I think.
Yeah, like 2 miles.
Yeah, it's so small. And on top of that, it's less dense than water. So, I mean, this thing would float if you put it in the ocean. It's really not heavy at all. There's just not much mass there. And what also surprises me is that, you know, I don't know if you've seen the photos of all the outgassing that's taking place on the comet. For something
just
so
beautiful.
Small to be, yeah, for something so small to be spitting out gas, you'd think there wouldn't be much of it left. Although it doesn't do that the whole time. It just does it when it's, you know, closer to the sun.
Yeah.
Just, I guess, just for a couple months or so. But yeah, it's just spewing stuff in every which direction.
Yeah. So yeah, as we were getting ready to land Rosetta on the comet surface, we started looking for Philae. And we found a couple of different candidates, which are basically flecks in images, little bright flecks. And so we thought that we'd figured out which one it was, and then before we could actually get confirmation, Philae woke up and started transmitting data up to Rosetta, which is really, really cool. And so far it's been able to get 300 packets up to Rosetta that were then relayed back to Earth. But it's got 8,000 more packets of data. And so once we collect all that, then we'll tell it to start doing science again, because there's more science for it to collect. But they got wattage results and temperature results, and the thing seems to be fine. So maybe they'll be able to rock it into a better position or something. They talked about being able to do that earlier before they ran out of power the first time. So yeah, so hopefully we'll get to see Philae continue to chug along. It's really, really cool. And did you see how ESA made the announcement?
No, how do they make it?
So they called a press conference, and then like an hour before the press conference started, they had the Philae Twitter account tweet something like, "Hello from Churiguri," or something like that.
I probably did see that. I didn't know that was the first announcement, but yep. That's how I found out about most news is on Twitter. That's my news source. And I just saw I was just watching a little bit of the conference that was held, I think about 3 days ago. It was like a five panel type of a conference. And I think at that point they had just found out that it had woken up. So, good news. And they're very happy, and they think that they're going to be able to keep it running at least through September of next year. I mean, the actual mission ends on December 31st, but they think that they have enough power and so forth that they can keep going through September. So that's very impressive. So they're going to try to keep on doing science well into next year.
So fantastic.
It's working out. Let's translate on over to our next topic, the New Horizons spacecraft. So I've been hearing about this for years now, and we're getting there.
Yeah, so the big date that we're talking about is July 14th, which is after our next show. So I didn't want to go too much into detail here, but
it's also Bastille Day, right? Sorry.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, July 14th.
Okie doke.
Anyway.
As New Horizons nears Pluto, we've been hearing more and more out of NASA, and they've started doing weekly progress updates on NASA TV, which is really cool. And they actually have some pretty good data in there and some good interviews that are really entertaining. And so the reason I wanted to mention this in the show was because I watched an interview that they, again, posted on YouTube. We'll link to this. It's absolutely fantastic. But they talked a lot about the design of New Horizons. And so, you know, I was familiar with the way that New Horizons was constructed. It's basically a shiny triangle with a dish on one side, one of the big flat sides, and then on the three edges, it's got some science instruments, including a few that were designed by students, which is really cool. And then on one of the apices of the triangle, they have an RTG, and that was kind of all that I knew about it. But I found out some really cool things from this interview that really made me excited about the vehicle as a vehicle, not just as, you know, something that's flying out to towards Pluto. So did you hear any of this?
I watched the video. I think the one that you provided the link for, and we will have in the show notes. They had discussed the heat management, and I think that's what you're talking about, right? And this is really important when you're as far away as Pluto.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. So to keep the vehicle warm, normally you have heaters on the vehicle, and you have to spend energy on those heaters, and that energy is being taken away from your science instruments. And when you're doing outer solar system missions, you're already having to fight for every single watt of power. And so what's really cool is they decided not to spend any heat on heating the vehicle. And what they do is they have heat pipes from the RTG being pulling heat in towards the vehicle. And so they actually pick up 200 watts of heat, of just waste heat, which is really fantastic. And what's really cool is that they can shut down or limit that amount of heat, or at least they did in the design. One of the last things they designed was the way that the RTG was mounted on the spacecraft. And that mounting fixture, they actually were able to, you know, build at the last minute and build it so that it transferred the right amount of heat into the vehicle. So they were able to pick that amount and then mount the RTG at the very last minute, you know, as it's on the pad. That's when you install dangerous things like radioisotope thermal generators. No, radioisotope thermoelectric generator.
Oh, I didn't know the electric was in there. Okay.
Yeah, that's why RTG is a good place to use an acronym. But what's really cool is that that RTG, is since it's a fixed amount of heat that's coming in, they were able to pick how much heat. But once they picked it, it's a fixed amount of heat. And so what's really, really cool is that there's software on the spacecraft that monitors the temperature and can fine tune how much energy is using on internal systems to either add to that temperature or go low enough that you're radiating heat away from the vehicle. And that is absolutely amazing. So, I mean, grabbing waste heat from an RTG makes sense. But then controlling how much electricity you're using to power the vehicle to either heat up or cool down the vehicle as heat radiates away is just about the coolest and most difficult thing to pull off that I have ever heard of on a spacecraft.
Are you saying then what the spacecraft is doing is that it's actually generating a certain amount of electrical resistance, which is creating the heat?
Yeah, and that's something that's going to happen anytime that you're using electricity and, you know, electronic components as we know them. That's just something that's going to happen, but it can change that value by using more or less electricity for all of its onboard systems.
That is pretty innovative. Instead of basically creating a whole other system just responsible for, you know, keeping it warm, you just use the ones that you have on board that are already using that energy, and then you simply put it to secondary use. You're basically using the waste heat for something else other than just letting it, you know, radiate out into space.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, in the video that I saw, like, they designed the spacecraft in such a way that, like, anything that needs to be maintained at a certain temperature is inside of this box where all the heat is, and then anything that needs to stay absolutely cold is mounted on the outside, which of course makes sense.
Yeah, I'd like to call this the brown fat approach.
What is the brown fat approach?
Oh, so brown fat is the adipose tissue inside your body that basically burns food calories and turns them into heat.
Like is that what they mean by it's not healthy cholesterol, but it's the other, it's like healthy fat, right?
Yeah, it's good fat. Yeah, brown fat is good fat.
Okay.
And so this is basically that same thing. Instead of being really skinny and sitting in front of a space heater, they've basically made the spacecraft to have brown fat on board that can take care of that whole process itself. So that's really cool. The other thing I wanted to mention was, I actually talked to my dad about this earlier. So, hey dad, the communication system on New Horizons is really cool. They only have one dish, on one side of the spacecraft, but it's actually a three-mode, device. It's got an omnidirectional antenna on top, which basically allows you to talk to the satellite no matter what orientation it's in. And that's something that if you want to have a good robust vehicle, you just got to have an omni antenna. But the omni antenna is mounted as far away from the vehicle as possible, which happens to be on top of the satellite dish. And what's really cool is that it's not just one satellite dish. There are two satellite dishes nested inside of each other. So there's a small low gain dish Well, so there's the Omni Antenna on top, then there's a small low-gain dish in the middle, and a big high-gain dish on the bottom. And, of course, the low-gain dish has got a much wider field of view, so you can get pretty close to pointing at Earth and then get low-gain data that'll tell you exactly where to point, and then you can have the high-gain dish really focus in. But, again, the crazy thing about this is they're all stacked on top of each other. They're not in separate systems. You have to look at it to get it. They're all on top of each other. It's so cool. It looks like a pyramid.
Was that done just to conserve space? Because there's a lot of other instruments that, you know, have to be exposed. So, yeah, this is just putting antennas on top of antennas just to save room.
Yeah, space and mass is what you're saving. Yeah, so cool. And, I mean, the amount of engineering that had to go into that is got to be insane.
Especially for, it took 9 years to get to Pluto.
Yeah.
Yeah, you want to make sure that everything is working correctly. This is such an ambitious project in that sense, you know, because it's 9 years away and they had to put it on super fast rockets just so, you know, the principal investigators weren't dead by the time I got there.
Yeah. And it's super, super light and, it has a speed record. And
how fast is it going?
I don't know off the top of my head. It's going fast enough that it's going to, zip out into the Kuiper Belt. It's already got escape velocity. So it's going to head out into the Kuiper Belt and we have two different candidates for objects for it to look out there, And then it's going to zip off into the outer solar system. And so hopefully we're going to be able to keep it alive and keep getting data, you know, Voyager-like data. But yeah, our third vehicle to get escape velocity. It's pretty cool.
To escape the solar system. That's so neat.
Hey, guess what? We're going to talk about SpaceX.
Finally. Who knew? Who saw that coming? Yeah, well, this actually is not a very big SpaceX story. This isn't even so much about SpaceX, but more about the SES company. What does that stand for?
I don't know. They're based in Luxembourg, and that's all I know about them. I don't know what SES stands for.
Yeah, they're basically a satellite fleet operator. I don't know what it stands for, SES, but yeah, they are based in Luxembourg, and they put all kinds of satellites into space. And so what they want to do is they want to purchase, essentially, or I think you put in the notes here they want to purchase, but it's more like they want to reuse a first stage booster because they're hoping to get a significant cut in the price, which I think is a great idea. The next launch that they're going to be doing with SpaceX is on sometime in September. They're going to be launching SES-9. I think that's a communication satellite. I'm not even sure what that one does.
Yeah, it's a communication satellite, and it's not the first that they've launched with SpaceX.
Right. In fact, I think they were one of SpaceX's first commercial customers, so they're probably like their biggest or most loyal customer, if you will. So what they want to do is they want to use that first stage booster from the launch of SES-9, which is, you know, coming up in September, and then they want to use it a second time for another payload. And they're hoping that, you know, if that can be done, then that should represent a huge savings for them because they don't have to pay for two first stage boosters. And I'm sure that SpaceX is more than willing to do that because this will be a great way of basically demonstrating that you can use a first stage more than once. I mean, and that's kind of what comes into my mind. And so the SES-9 mission in September, we spoke about it, I don't know how many episodes ago, but we were talking about how this is the mission where SpaceX is going to be quote unquote upgrading their hardware, which is the one where they're going to be, what was it? They're going to be super chilling the propellant so that they can get better ISP out of it or something like that, or better thrust.
I think they're just getting more fuel in there. I think that's a big deal.
I don't quite remember, but yeah, that's that flight, that one that we were talking about. And so they want to use the first stage from that, and they're hoping that it lands successfully on the barge.
Spaceport jump ship. We don't call them barges.
Whatever. Spaceport jumps. Well, hopefully we won't be using or calling them anything. Eventually they're going to be coming back to land. And so one thing I wanted to point out, as I was looking into this, I thought this was great. So the CTO of that company, Martin Hallowell, he had suggested, apparently he had spoken to Elon Musk at some point, and he said, why not put up nets on the drone ships in order to catch the first stage if it, you know, tips over? And of course, Elon Musk, he had simply replied, that's not cool. And that doesn't surprise me. Actually, it does a little bit because I think of him as being extremely pragmatic, but at the same time, he does have a certain amount of style, you know, and he's not going to put up nets.
Yeah.
You know, it's either going to land correctly, like as it should, or it just won't. They're not going to use nets, but that's not a bad idea.
Yeah, so it's really cool because, SES basically went to SpaceX and they're like, hey, so we want to be the first people to fly and, you know, fly on a reused booster, and you guys should give us a really big discount. And SpaceX was like, we'll talk about it. So the talks are not As far as I know, they're not about SES reusing a booster. They're about how big of a discount they're going to give them.
Right.
Which I think is a great attitude to be like, you know what? This is really cool, but it, you know, don't expect any favors.
But I mean, you can't blame them for trying it. And I think that is a good match because SpaceX wants to reuse a first staging.
Yeah.
And it might be like for any other customer, it might be difficult to convince them that, hey, this is just as good as a brand new first stage. So you can trust us. In this
case,
at
least for the first launch, right?
Yeah. Well, the first launch is fine. And then the second use of that first stage is.
Yeah. Well, I just mean like the first time that we're reflying a booster like this. Yeah. That might be a little difficult to convince somebody. But after that, I don't think it's going to be an issue.
No, probably not. But I think that there is still some hesitation and they have more confidence. And I was just saying that that's a good thing because most other customers probably wouldn't. Like, I don't see the government, you know, launching some kind of a top secret military payload on a booster that's already been used once. They're probably not going to do that. You know, I mean, and I'm sure that SpaceX knows what they're doing and I'm sure it'll work just fine, but no one has used a first stage more than once. So I'm just glad that there's at least this one company out there and they're like, yeah, we're all for it because you'll give us a discount, right? At least that's the idea. So
yeah, very, very, very cool.
Okay, stand by. We're looking at it.
All right, so let's do our questions, comments, and our correction burns. I think we only have one. And in your defense, this was so last episode, you were convinced that no solar sail had ever flown in space before, or at least before this most recent
was
one.
Was I convinced?
Well, you weren't convinced, but you were like, I don't remember.
I was pretty sure. I don't know if I was convinced.
Okay.
At this point, it doesn't matter. I was wrong.
What was the name of the, now I'm having trouble remembering the name of the one that the Planetary Society launched. Light Sail. Obviously, Light Sail. So Light Sail, as it turns out, was not the very first solar sail. That honor goes to, the Icaros spacecraft, which is a Japanese spacecraft. It was launched back in May of 2010 and it's still operational, actually. And so this was the one that I was referring to last episode, but I didn't know the name of it. I didn't really have any details. I just vaguely remembered that the Japanese had launched something that was a solar sail. This is pretty neat. So it's actually still in operation. It is in a heliocentric orbit. So it's currently orbiting the sun somewhere closer than Earth. I think somewhere like maybe around Venus. I'm not sure quite where it is. I don't remember the orbital period, but it shuts down through much of its orbit and then it comes back to life. It has done this four times. It is now in its fifth hibernation mode and then it'll come back out around, I guess, 10 months from now or so, somewhere around there. Yeah, so basically the honor, I think, does go to Icaros. In fact, they're even in the Guinness Book for being the very first solar sail spacecraft.
Yeah, they flew to Venus.
And this was pointed out by Reddit user 7657.
7357.
Oh, is it 73? Oh, it says you're 75.
Yeah, that's
well, whatever. The guy with the numbers.
Yeah, I'm telling you, 7357 does so much. They don't comment on every single episode, but when they do, they come in every three episodes or so, and they just have a ton of data, really good resources, and everything's referenced, and it's fantastic. And, okay, so before we leave talking about Icaros, I just wanted to real quick point out that this is another fantastic acronym. Icaros was the Greek legend or man of legend who flew too close to the sun. But Icaros, I-K-R-O-S, the satellite, stands for Interplanetary Kite Craft Accelerated by Radiation of the Sun. And
brilliant.
That's probably a backronym, and it sounds really cool.
And since this is a JAXA spacecraft, I guess the Japanese came up with that. They did. Boy, they sure know how to use English better than us. I don't know.
Yep.
That's
yep.
good. That's a clever little acronym.
Yeah,
Icaros.
Cool. Yep. It picked up 10 meters per second of delta V using its 100 meters per second.
100 meters per second?
100 meters per second. That's what 7357 says.
I'd have to go back and... Well, if
we're wrong about that, it's not us. It's 7357 and somebody can go correct them and not us.
Yes. Oh, I did want to mention really quickly, we got an email from a listener, Antoine from somewhere in Canada. I'm assuming Quebec. And
French Canada somewhere.
And he wanted some recommendations about good books to read. And I didn't have too many. And I know that you made a couple suggestions. So I wanted to put it out there to all of our listeners. And I'm going to tweet about it later. I really do want some good suggestions for spaceflight type books. I guess it could be fiction or nonfiction, right? Because you had a couple suggestions that are fiction. For example, The Martian.
Yeah. So, Antoine asked for top book recommendations specifically. exhaustive space flight history books that we often refer to, and Antoine said that most of the books that he's found are nationality or era specific, and he was looking for something that was a good an encyclopedia. He specifically wanted a homemade space-related encyclopedia. So, honestly, I've never referenced a print book unless it was archived online. I have zero spaceflight books in my house, which is something that I'd like to fix. And as soon as we got this email, I asked everybody on the Orbital Mechanics team, and nobody had any good recommendations. So I'm not super, I'm being pessimistic. I don't think that we're going to get that many good recommendations from listeners. And David really does.
Well,
please go prove him right, because I think it'd be really cool to have a list of books that we suggest as good, good books. And, you know, I would like to pick up some of these books if you guys can recommend them. So yeah, we're looking for encyclopedic type of books. Maybe era or nationality specific, but not if possible. And, we'd love to hear back from you guys.
Yeah. The only suggestions we had, you had said, you know, The Martian is one, which is a good fictional.
Yeah. I forgot to say that Antoine then asked about sci-fi suggestions.
Yeah.
And that's when I said, you got to watch The Martian.
I've read a lot of sci-fi, but I don't know if he's looking for, I'm thinking more like spaceflight sci-fi type stuff, not just sci-fi in general, which really could be anything. He had said that he had read, Fantastic Voyage, which is an old Jules Verne book.
He asked for a great sci-fi that was either space-related or not space-related. And all the sci-fi that I read is all about space.
Really?
That's pretty much all right. So The Martian was really, really good. I'm almost done with the Culture series by Ian M. Banks, and that's all about space. But a lot, you know, there's a lot of personal interaction, but it all takes place on very cool different types of space habitats, very rarely on the surface of a planet. And,
that's pretty neat. I probably don't really need any recommendations. I have about 20 books that I'm in the middle of reading. You know, I'm kind of one of those people. I read, you know, the first third or half of it, and then I get interested in something else. I can't seem to but it takes me a while to fully finish a book. But if it's really good, hard science fiction, I can usually get through it pretty quickly.
Yeah. Oh, and while we're talking about space or sci-fi, we've been talking about this on our end. And I want to let you guys know, so The Martian is coming out November the 2nd, I believe.
It's sometime in November.
Yeah, I believe it's November 2nd, and it's coming out in theaters. And so if you haven't read the book yet, I really, really hope that you'll go read the book. And honestly, the audiobook is a fantastic alternative. It's really, really good. The audiobook is read by R.C. Bray, and his talent for accents and emotion is so incredible. And he's used to doing like radio commercials. So I don't know where this guy came from, but so, so good. But go ahead and get caught up. And then go watch the movie as soon as you can. What we're going to do is hopefully I'm going to be able to make it down to L.A. So that I can watch the movie with Steve, our research assistant, and my dad. And then David's going to go see it, and Connor's going to go see it. And then we're all going to get together afterwards within a week of it opening, hopefully, if we can. But we're all going to get together, and we're going to record just like an hour conversation. If you listen to Adam Savage's podcast, Still Untitled, he does spoiler casts now and again where he just talks about, you know, movies or books. And so that's what we're going to do. We're going to do a spoiler cast. It's going to be really, really fun for us. Hopefully we'll produce something that's fun for you guys, but it'll be coming out as a separate episode. It won't take the place of a full episode. We'll throw it out there. So join us. This is going to be really fun.
That's like 5 months away. Yeah. So yeah. Yep. Well, good. Thanks for mentioning that. And now that you've said it's like, the Adam Savage spoiler casting, I totally get what you're saying. That does explain it to me. Cause I've watched a lot of those. I've watched all those things.
He did the Martian spoiler cast when he read the book.
Yeah. See, I haven't even seen that. I'd forgotten about it. I think I'm still subscribed to his YouTube channel, but I haven't watched any of those in quite a while. It kind of slipped my mind.
Yeah, I'm real picky about what I watch on that channel.
Yeah, me too. Anyway, that was a long discussion about books, but yeah, so the short answer is we want some book suggestions. Or the short question is, give us some book suggestions.
Okay, so are we going to move on to the next segment now?
So now let's talk about some fireflies.
I am so excited about this, you guys.
All right, so today we are going to have, we have a special show. We have four engineers from Firefly Space Systems, and I think we're really excited about this, right, Ben?
Yo, yeah, totally, totally excited.
So I think we're going to maybe skip a little bit of what Firefly does, because I think most people know, but if not, we can do a brief introduction. But first thing I want to do is actually introduce all four of these people. So in no particular order, just go ahead and tell us who you are and what you do at Firefly as brief as you can.
Okay.
So whoever wants to go first.
I guess to lead off. My name is Alex Weldon, and I lead our materials and processes efforts here at Firefly. So basically everything the rocket's made out of and then the way that we make it. My personal background, I'm from the Northwest back in Oregon. I did my undergrad at Princeton and then my PhD and postdoc at Lehigh University. So I spent some time in the Northeast, then kind of made a triangle and came down here to Austin. And I've been here since August.
Did you say Princeton? You can brag a little bit.
Yeah, Princeton PhD, Dr. Weldon over here is awesome.
Yeah. Our CEO is also a Princeton alum, so that's how I kind of got hooked up with Firefly.
Oh, nice.
That does help.
Next, Forrest Ward here. I hail from Alabama. Graduated a year ago from Auburn University in aerospace and got lucky enough to have my resume forwarded to Tom by an employee at NASA Marshall, who I worked with on a senior design project. Most of the past year, I've been a propulsion engineer, designing engine components for our first hot fire test article. But lately, I moved on more to trajectory analysis and guidance, navigation, and control.
This is Chris Craighill. I've been working a lot. Well, okay, I hail from the D.C. area, Northern Virginia. Down here in Austin, I am basically working on engine systems, particularly the first stage I've been focusing on lately. So both the engine modules as well as the aerospike. Yeah, doing CFD analysis and heat transfer analysis, structural analysis, that kind of thing.
And for reference, CFD is computational fluid dynamics. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, you said that in your intro email that you sent us, and I was like, CFD. Okay, I know what that is.
Yeah.
And last but not least.
So my name is Jenny Hannabut. I am coming here from the University of Kansas, where I graduated in 2012. Then started my master's degree and got lured away by the new space industry, where I worked for about a year before moving down to Austin, Texas. And I'm working on secondary structures, so interstage, skirts, separation mechanisms, and basically how we connect Chris's aerospike to the vehicle.
So I was thinking, because we have our questions kind of all hodgepodge, but a lot of our listeners, I think, are probably most curious about the aerospike engines. I thought that maybe the first thing that we can do, maybe this is a question for Chris, if we can get a brief in simple but not too simple terms, if that doesn't make it too hard, can you give us a brief step-by-step of the FRE2 cycle of, you know, that particular engine cycle? And also, what does FRE stand for? I'm assuming Firefly engine, but I'm not really sure.
Yeah, exactly. Firefly rocket engine. And two, because it's the second one we're developing. The upper stage engine is further along at the moment. We're basically almost on the test stand with an engine very similar to our upper stage engine. So yeah, so the aerospike, that whole engine configuration, we've got currently a dozen modules around it. I know that there are some old pictures where I think we were at maybe 8 or 10. I don't remember what number that was. You know, as we design things and figure out the masses and propellant mass fractions and that kind of thing of the rocket, you know, design choices can change. So anyway, so we've got a cluster of engines around the aerospike, and the aerospike itself, of course, basically functions as sort of like an extended bell nozzle, except that it's a nozzle that compensates for altitude in a way that a fixed bell doesn't. Obviously, if you had a perfect variable nozzle, bell nozzle, that would be the optimal scenario, but that's, I don't believe anybody's ever built one of those. So, so this is sort of the next best thing if you want altitude compensation. Basically, it allows the exhaust gas to expand against the surface and provide thrust to the vehicle.
And also, I think you might have already mentioned it is a methane-based engine. I mean, this is a Methalox engine, right?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we've actually got two development paths going right now. There's a lot of experience within the team on RP, so we've got an RP engine going, and then we've also got methane development going. So, you know, as a startup, it's important to minimize risks, and so we want to develop all of our new technologies and make alpha best in class, sort of. But You know, you've got to be careful that you're not biting off more than you can chew. So we've got a few people who are sort of familiar with methane engines, but we've got a lot more experience with RP. And so we're sort of developing both in parallel, I guess I would say.
Okay. Yeah, I was not aware of that at all. I thought you guys were strictly just working on methane. I didn't know that at all. So there's some very interesting features here. I think, Ben, you had some questions regarding basically how the propellant is fed, because that's a pretty innovative idea.
Yeah. So you guys are using a pressure-fed system. Is that correct?
Yep, that's right. It's a pressure-fed rocket.
And what's really cool about your pressure feed is that you're not using helium for back pressure, right?
Well, on the methane version, you're absolutely right. On the methane version, it'll be autogenous press. The RP version will use helium because you can't evaporate RP at those pressures. So you're right.
So autogenous, right? I'm pronouncing that right?
Yeah, autogenous, mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
I can spell it. I can't pronounce it. So autogenous pressurization means that you're pressurizing with the material that you're burning. So from what I understand, you have like a tap off from your combustion chamber or from your gas expander cycle that then feeds into the tank. Is that right?
That's interesting. No, not currently. That's not the current design. You can do it a couple of ways, of course. One is you can bring heat up into the propellants via something like a heat pipe and have the heat exchanger inside of the propellants and control your energy flux into the propellants. Or you can bring the methane itself, tap off a bit of it and run it through a heat exchanger, you know, maybe run it through the aerospike or maybe run it through one of the engines, something like that. And that also allows you to pressurize. So I guess I can't say for sure that we won't be, but that's not currently in the plans is to tap off combustion gas from the...
Yeah, I misspoke. I meant the gas generator cycle. So one of the things that I saw was that you guys were thinking about, you're using a gas generator, so you're running liquid fuel and liquid oxygen through elements that need to be cooled, basically, and that turns everything into a nice fluffy gas, which is easier to burn. It's nice and hot. And then you're dumping some of that You're potentially dumping some of that back into the tanks before you burn it, right?
We actually won't be using a gas generator.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's a different engine cycle. I think you might be confused on what a gas generator cycle
that's
is
not
compared
true.
To this.
Take it back.
Yeah, they're not actually like running the pumps, you know, from combusted gases and then dumping it overboard, yeah. Which is what a gas generator would be.
Thinking of an expander cycle.
Right.
Right, which is still kind of, yeah, that's closer. Yeah, although, yeah, yeah.
So we won't be pumping our fuels in that way. We'll be using pressure purely. And so we'll be obviously pressurizing within the tanks. And so whereas on a normal sort of pump fed engine, your tanks might be at something like 50 PSI. We'll be up much higher than that into the hundreds of PSI. So.
Okay. So you don't have a turbo pump at all. You're just running off of pressure.
That's right.
Right. The pressure fed is the alternative to any sort of pump cycle.
And so if you guys end up using RP1, you're going to need a turbo. Is that right?
No, not necessarily. So I guess Alex could talk more about this, but our goal is to stay pressure fed, and that is why we're using composite tanks.
And that's when helium would come into play. So we'd pressurize with helium instead of the methane.
Okay.
Basically, yeah.
So that's very interesting, because I was just thinking that when you had mentioned that you were using RP1, I was thinking, well, then how are you going to pump that fuel and oxidizer? The core technology here that you're going to be using on both engines, or I guess I should say potentially, since you're perhaps like still up in the air about it, is that you're going to be using these highly pressurized tanks. Now, how are these tanks able to be pressurized to such high degrees? Because I kind of already know the answer, but for the sake of our listeners, explain what makes these tanks so special.
Really, the only way that you can make a pressure-fed rocket work is through the use of composite tanks, because otherwise you just take too big of a mass hit using either completely metal tanks or using the way the field's kind of been moving is towards using a metal liner with a composite overwrap.
Let me add real quick. I think the French made the Diamant that was one of the stages was pressure fed, but it ran at much lower pressures. And so you can do it out of metal if you're running at quite low pressures. But again, it's certainly not as efficient as carbon. We're looking at pushing those pressure limits. So.
And you guys said that you're looking at something on the order of hundreds of PSI?
Yes.
Yeah, on the order of hundreds of PSI for the propellant tanks, and then up into thousands of PSI for the pressurant tanks.
Right.
Carbon fiber, as you know, is like kind of the novel next generation material, and it's very uniquely suited for holding these very, very high pressure gases and such.
About how many PSI like would you get with a regular tank on, let's say, a cryogenic stage engine? Like, about what are you looking at there?
I mean, I would say in the high hundreds would be about where we'd be, yeah. So we're looking about an order of magnitude more than, for instance, a pump-fed rocket, where you'd be looking at maybe 30, 40, 50 PSI.
Okay, so we were talking a little bit about FRE2, your aerospike engine. The way that aerospikes work is that you've got combustion chambers that sit kind of high up on the rocket. And then instead of having a big bell underneath that, you have a spike that sticks down, and you're pressing all of your exhaust gas against that spike and then against the atmosphere that surrounds it. So there are some photos that are kind of floating around, and it looks like you guys have got, instead of linear or toroidal combustion chambers, it looks like you've got a series of like circular combustion chambers with like tiny little bells on them. Can you talk about the way that that setup works?
Sure. Yeah, you're right. So in the literature, you'll find a lot of annular aerospikes, and usually it would be even a full aerospike. And so that's the situation where you've got an entire one continuous combustion chamber all the way around, like a toroidal type of shape. And the problem with that is that it can be pretty hard to cool. And then you've got, of course, the full-length aerospike, and there's a lot of literature data on that, too. And then you start making these modifications to it, and people study, you know, you can do what we call this plug cluster configuration, and where instead of the annular configuration. And people said, well, yeah, that's a lot easier to make. We know how to make your typical thrust chamber, and we know how to cool those, and we know how that all works. And so what if we, instead of making this annular combustion chamber that would be totally new, you know, development and seemingly quite difficult to do, let's just put cluster a bunch of engines around it. And so, people have tended to go in that direction. That does, of course, you know, provide some, you know, or sort of cost you some, performance, at least as far as, if you're going to fully expand against the aerospike. But what you can do, and what we're sort of doing, is hedging between bell area ratio, you know, and bell expansion with, aerospike expansion. So the aerospike, you know, really serves a few purposes on our rocket. And we like to have as many things as possible on the rocket be multi-use, in this way, which is, it's a heat exchanger for the helium on the RP, or it's a heat exchanger for the methane, on the autogenously pressed, rocket. And then, of course, it also provides a thrust bonus. So you do, I guess, take a performance hit with the clustered configuration, but the annular configuration is very difficult to make work. And then, and you'll notice also, as I said, that we have our aerospike truncated. There's a lot of literature data out there, that talks about the effects of truncating the aerospike and how you get a very high percentage efficiency compared to the full length aerospike. And you can imagine that if you've got this full length, 100% length aerospike, when it gets very skinny down at the bottom, that becomes basically impossible to cool. So we truncated it, and that's sort of a rough outline of our configuration.
So from what I understand, when you truncate the spike, you also get a slight performance boost, because you're able to develop a high pressure region in that triangular gap kind of bit. Is that something that you guys are seeing in your simulations?
Yep, absolutely. That's absolutely right. You get this sort of wake closure as you ascend through the atmosphere. You can imagine that all the plumes are more or less separated down at the base region when you're down at 14.7 PSI, because, you know, as they're coming out of the bell, they're going to be at lower pressure than that. And so you get a little pocket in there. And as you rise, that pocket sort of closes as the atmospheric pressure decreases in there. And then you get sort of a trapped base pressure region, where it's basically sort of free thrust.
Cool. So one of our listeners asked us a question on our subreddit. This was, user Zaglim. And he actually asked a question that I was already geared up to ask. So I'm going to just insert it right here. When NASA built their J2-derived annular aerospike, they actually had some of the gas, I believe, from the combustion chamber that got injected into that area underneath the aerospike, and they got some like secondary flow characteristics. Are you guys planning on having anything, you know, any extra gas injectors down there or anything?
Right. Yeah. We're looking at base bleed. So one of the issues with it is, right now, since we're using the aerospike as a heat exchanger, you know, we could bleed either unburned propellant, you know, unburned methane down into the base, or we could bleed helium down into the base. And either way, you're not getting sort of, you know, in the case of the helium, you're sort of adding extra helium onto your rocket. And the question is that extra mass that you're carrying worth the thrust that you get from the base bleed? And it looks like preliminary, it probably is not. If you can find a way to route engine exhaust through there, then that's great. But there's no easy way for us to do that right now. So I don't think we'll be using base bleed right now, but there's always a possibility that that comes into play.
Yeah, and actually, to correct myself, I think it was actually turbine exhaust.
Right, so if you have a pump, then that's a perfect synergy.
Yeah, and you guys aren't using that. And so do you guys know what the bottom of your spike is going to look like? Because right now it looks like a big fan kind of – like it looks like there's – I don't know. Like
I think that those are the vanes through which the propellant is circulating.
Oh, is that
right?
What that is?
It looks like I don't know.
Yeah, I think I remember the picture that you're talking about, and I think I can just – safely say it's outdated CAD at this point.
Yeah, that's my guess. But.
Yeah. So I mean, basically, we'll be cooling that, you know, in the same way that we cool the rest of the spike. And so I don't think you can just stick metal down there uncooled, I guess is what I would say.
Yeah, that picture is back from early August of last year, and things here have changed so dramatically since then. It's hard to keep up with the latest pictures because things change on a daily basis so quickly.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, you guys don't have nightly build photos you can release, huh?
You know, it's also worth noting that that modular aerospike design with the clustered bells is amenable to like a step-by-step development. You develop one of the modules first, and then a similar upper stage engine, and then cluster them in that FRE2 engine. So that's kind of a safe development process.
Yeah. So how similar, my guess is that, you know, if you're already developing these engines, it seems kind of a simple next step to just cut and paste it to turn it into, you know, your second stage propulsion. Don't laugh at me.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely going down the right track. Like everything about our rocket is definitely designed for mass producibility and shared components. So whether that be the propellant tanks trying to maximize similarities there, or absolutely using the exact same thrust chambers of a single one for the second stage versus a dozen for the first stage.
And you started with FRE1, the upper stage engine, right? So I guess you're dragging that down to the bottom of the engine and slapping it around,
smaller nozzle.
Absolutely. Yes.
That's really cool.
Right. That's been the source of a lot of confusion here with the FRE2 being on the first stage. But that's the idea is that we develop an upper stage esque system first.
We promise we're developing cooler names. We will sometimes hit 6:30 at night and you'll see Tom just kick back and start trying to throw out an engine name. Nothing's stuck yet.
Okay, what's the worst name that's come across so far?
Lupus.
So I was looking for just like really cool Latin words, and in a just moment of pure just thinking engineering, nothing else, I was like, lupus.
Yeah, wolves. Wolves are awesome, right? What's the Latin for wolf?
Lupus. And
it's also a disease. Yeah, that sounds
exactly.
Like
that was my bad.
Sorry, that's what I'm going to call it from now on.
the lupus engine. I had a question about going back to those engines. I had read some stuff about there's some people who are kind of speculative or not speculative. There's some people who are
they're downright mean.
A little bit doubtful about the efficiency of the aerospike design. So I'm wondering, and correct me if this is a little bit too simple, but is it possible for me to ask what the ISP of a single engine is and then compare that to the whole aerospike design, meaning that that should give you a good metric of the difference in efficiency or in other words, the difference in the specific impulse. So if you just took one engine nozzle and then you said this is the ISP, and then you took the whole thing as a group and you said this is the ISP, that should be a pretty good metric, right? Or is that like simplifying it too much because there's differences in...
Yeah, you're looking at in the neighborhood of like a 5-10% efficiency gain from the aerospike. And so, you know, you could say, is it even worth it then? But really it is because, well, first of all, we need a heat exchanger. And second of all, it's light. You know what I mean? It more than pays for itself as far as thrust. And so it's really just free performance.
And especially thinking about that we do have a very small rocket and we are kind of catering to the small satellite market. So with payloads of around 1,000 pounds for our first rocket, around 1,000 kilograms for our second rocket. Like every pound really does count.
So I'd like to ask you guys some stuff about reusability. So, you know, the material that's out there, is saying that you guys are beginning to work in potentially reusable parts now and making sure that they're, you know, good to go So that if you guys, you know, get to the point where you can start actually putting reusability into practice, you've already got, you know, all of the parts and all the infrastructure there. Do you guys have any, you know, good ideas of what that reusability is going to look like?
So we're starting off with Alpha 1.0A and following the simplest, soonest orbit and making a rocket that is not reusable. That one's going to be just quick, dirty, not poorly engineered, but then thrown away. Next is Beta, where we are going to have those two booster stages and then the main core. And that one also we're talking about not reusing as well because it's going to be a cheap rocket. Correct, Alex? Mm-hmm. We're not reusing Beta. And then the final one is Gamma. So Gamma takes off horizontally and lands horizontally. I'm sure you've seen the rocket plane.
Yeah, well, I've seen photos of Gamma, but I've never heard anybody talk about it. So do you guys mind spending some more time talking about it? Because it's such a cool-looking vehicle.
I think it's definitely important to realize that as a small company, like we are like kind of a laser focused right now on our alpha vehicle, but every company kind of has aspirations and that's kind of where we're going.
Yeah. So we're not working on Gamma yet. What you saw was kind of a quick concept that I guess some of us worked on. Half of our team kind of got a week of just let's develop a Gamma vehicle as a concept. So it's a base model, but we're going to work towards it in the future, but we can answer some questions.
Yeah, horizontal takeoff, horizontal landing. Really trying to take advantage of those aerodynamic forces, whether that be lift or drag, as well as kind of your normal vertical launch.
Wow, that's crazy. I've heard a lot of people propose it, but I don't think I've seen anybody actually say, hey, this is something that we'd like to do as a company. That's really crazy.
Yeah, and the awesome thing about Gamma is the first stage is going to be fully reusable.
Oh, so you'd put something on top of that. It's not like a single stage or anything.
Oh, gosh, no, it's not single stage.
Okay.
I was just wondering that because I was thinking about just how incredibly difficult borderlining on, you know, completely just not possible that is. Yeah. Well, no, I don't know, but I have more faith in single stage orbit than Ben, but yeah, still, it's just, this is two stages, and the first stage is going to land, and it's just going to have, I guess, this giant exposed forward section, but that is not going to make
Have you guys thought about how you would lop off the front of what is essentially a rocket plane and still be able to land it?
Because it would be hitting, what, Mach 4 or 5 at that point?
So the idea would be, we traded around a lot of ideas in this case, and some of them crazier than the next, but right now we're baselining the idea of the fairing opening and then the second stage coming out either with pushers or some sort of mechanism to push the second stage out, close back up the fairing, and then fly back. We have some animations that when they get released, that was something I worked on. It was one of the coolest animations I've ever put together. So
yeah, is there a mailing list I can get on to see those when they're released? Because that's really cool.
Yeah, to be honest, one of the coolest things about working in a new space company is just emails that you get traded around and the crazy ideas.
Yeah, I mean, it's 50 people, one big room, like, we all sit within 10 feet of the CEO. So
I saw an interview with PJ King. I believe it was his appearance on Tomorrow. He was asked about reusability and he said that he expected it to cut your launch price in half. Have you guys done any studies that would suggest if that's still your best guess, having the cost or?
Well, I think that'd be very accurate. I mean, certainly if you're reusing a large number of either your propulsion structures or your secondary structures, like after your initial NREs, your non-recurring expenses, that's where your costs are coming from. So, I mean, obviously you have to top it off with fuel and oxygen again. But I think those numbers are accurate.
Yeah, it also depends on how you go about reusability. Parachutes are pretty expensive, and there have been studies on reusing parachutes. Correct me if I'm wrong. In my previous experience, we were trying to reuse some parachutes, but parachutes can get expensive. We're talking about probably around $100,000 for a set of parachutes. So that's why the horizontal takeoff and landing is really beneficial and great, because you don't have to deal with parachutes and you can just top off and go, as opposed to taking parachutes off, restuffing in parachutes and taking all that time.
You can utilize the air to slow you down, use existing, runway architecture to land on.
So why not vertical propulsive landing?
Well, we want to burn up all of our fuel. That's part of it. Don't get me wrong, vertical propulsive landing is really cool. Those fins are just awesome. But we want to burn up as much fuel and take that to orbit.
And so I guess the question then is, so you believe that you can make wings that are lighter than fuel?
Yes.
Awesome.
Well, not just wings that are lighter than fuel, but also landing gear. Would have Well, I was just saying that kind of a concept would also have lift. So does this mean that?
That's true, because you get overall performance boosts.
If you're in the atmosphere, why not take advantage of it?
So one of our Reddit subscribers, @Astra42, wants to know where's your. I'm not sure what he means here, but where's your next launch site going to be? It says maybe it might be in Boca Chica. Do you have any information on that?
We're still trading around a bunch of launch sites, and actually Forrest does a lot of trajectory analysis from various launch points to determine what's optimal. So Forrest,
yeah,
you would know.
So the trajectory is intimately mated with the launch site, and down near Boca Chica, in that area, you have to do kind of some FAA required dogleg maneuvers and expend a lot of fuel to dodge Florida and so on and dodge these populated areas. That's obviously less than optimal.
Is that true just for inclined orbits, or the map in my head says that if you go horizontally, you've got more to worry about islands than, but I could be totally wrong. What do you think?
I think due east is about the only thing you can feasibly get, or you know, some sort of east launch without dangerous overflights, and that even with some sort of dogleg maneuver.
Oh, okay.
South, you start to kind of go over parts of Mexico, and north is just not an option because of the contiguous U.S.
That darn east coast.
Yep.
We frequently joke as a group that we should pick Hawaii so that more people want to join the launch team.
Yeah. I like that idea.
Have you guys thought about using NASA's recently announced deployable launch system?
That's definitely something that we're considering as we're vetting all these launch sites. And really, we're trying to just like work hand in hand with potential customers, like whether people are looking for equatorial launches or more towards the polar direction. But absolutely, like NASA's reusable or NASA's deployable launch system really is targeting vehicles about our size. So
yeah, and I believe that they're primarily targeting Methalox vehicles, which could be handy.
The first and second stages on the Firefly Alpha, how are those being brought together, and exactly how will they separate? In other words, are they going to be some kind of, I guess like the space shuttle would use explosive bolts, at least for, you know, tanks in various stages. How is that going to work?
So we want to avoid explosive bolts. With explosive bolts, you have to shut down the range and only have a few people be able to approach the vehicle when you're actually installing them. So from a integration standpoint, explosive bolts are being avoided. So what we're looking at right now are a few latches, like probably three latches that hold the two stages together that mate at a joint of some sort. It's called the tongue and groove joint. It basically is two pieces that come together, male and a female side, and then latches. And then we traded a bunch of really cool options, but what ended up winning out is traditional pushers. So three push arms to create a plane that impact a force that will separate the two vehicles. Forrest wanted fire in the hole.
Yeah, I thought we were going fire in the hole.
So where you just blow up the interstage.
How are you going to integrate all your electronics and everything? Do you have to route those on the outside of the carbon fiber, or do you get to embed those?
So routing electronics, we're trading a couple of ideas, one of which would be routing it actually through the tank itself, which is extremely tricky. The common dome is very sensitive. We don't want any leaks, obviously, across it. That would just turn it into a giant bomb. The other option would be to route it on the side with a raceway cover, so an aerodynamic fairing.
Well, are you already having to go through whichever tank you have on the bottom? Probably has to have a through pipe, right?
The tank on the bottom does, but we're talking about routing them around the common dome and basically punching some holes in the common dome with tubes through it.
Absolutely, yeah. So we're trading a few options, or you could throw it up in the interstage or down kind of towards the propulsion side.
And so it's not an option to route that stuff on the outside of the vehicle? Would that just cause too many problems with the aerodynamics and so forth? I mean, if you're just talking about wires, which I assume is what Ben's question was, right?
Yes.
So there are some positives to routing it on the outside. You have the ability to access it, and if there's anything that goes wrong, any leaks with the plumbing or the electronics, you can access it and do troubleshooting there. It does add some extra weight because you do have to have an aerodynamic fairing that gets attached to the vehicle. Again, we can't bolt through these carbon tanks at all. so it's probably going to have to be bonded on with extra glass tape, so you really have to trade manufacturability and weight for the two.
From a GNC standpoint, those raceways, those electronic raceways can actually provide some dampening and roll, so kind of act as like tiny little fins, so there are actually some small benefits to having those.
If you've like more than one.
Yeah.
So if we just have one, it's going to impose a roll moment, which we'll have to probably, we'll have to gimbal out, but.
So are you guys planning on doing vertical or horizontal integration, Dina?
We're talking about doing horizontal integration. Yeah. And one of the really cool things that we've come up with and changed in our integration standpoint that's new and innovative is we want to integrate the first stage and the second stage without the payload attached. So we'd have a bunch of vehicles ready to go without the payload. And then if something happens with a satellite, it's acting up, they need to tweak some stuff, we can just take our secondary payloads, we'll have like 15 payloads lined up, attach it to the rocket, and get ready to go. So we're able to change our payload and launch schedule on the fly if something would be happening to one of the satellites. So basically just have a bunch of cores ready to go and put a payload on top and go.
Plug and play.
So let me ask another question, which probably should have been somewhere towards the top of the interview. For the Firefly Alpha, can you roughly describe the ascent profile, meaning if you can speak on the G-load it's going to experience and exactly when the staging will happen, or roughly when the staging will happen, that kind of thing. Just give us some idea of that, because this is for all – I mean, this is for payload, and it's not for people, so I imagine it's going to be a little bit different than what most people are used to seeing with something, you know, like the space shuttle. Plus, it has all these composite tanks, and I don't know if that affects the ascent profile at all. I don't know, so. If you can maybe give us a little bit more information on that.
Right. The you can abuse it a little more if it's, you know, payload, not people. But the composite tanks actually and our pressure fed cycle actually yield an infinitely stiff rocket, or one that can be treated as infinitely stiff. So you know, you can kind of further abuse the loads because the rocket can take it, because it's just a big stiff balloon that kind of bends at the inner stage. But it's actually kind of a funny story. Starting out looking at, you know, the ascent profile with, trajectory tools, we kind of let those tools optimize our payload or maximize our payload by minimizing the losses that it experienced. And what those tools kind of find when you apply them is that, they really just speed through, turn over really, really fast and just speed through the lower atmosphere and really abuse the vehicle and induce a lot of heating rates. And we kind of took a second. We were getting, you know, pretty good payload numbers, but then kind of stepped back and took a closer look at some of the subtle details like heating rate, and realized that trajectory was yielding heat rates that would like melt the resin of the carbon composite. Wow. Yeah.
How far along are you in actually putting together this rocket and flying it? In other words, how close are you with the various component integration? And also, I just kind of had as a side question, how difficult in your experience has that been? Because I've heard it said that you can have every single component working great, but when you have to put them all together in the form of a rocket, like ultimately that's the hardest thing, and then that's where all the little gremlins come out and everything gets really, really complicated. How is that whole process going?
Well, I would say kind of as of yet, we've been focused on a couple really key technological proof of concepts. And that's been really focusing on getting an engine on the test stand, which should be this summer, and then pressing a full-scale tank. That means pressurizing to our hundreds of PSI a wholly composite tank at cryogenic conditions, and that should be within the next 6 months. That being said, as we're kind of moving towards that, now we're focusing a lot more on those kind of secondary and kind of auxiliary integration sorts of things. So we are keeping that in mind and marching towards it. But right now, we've just been really focused on those big flame coming out of the end of the rocket and such. Because those are the biggest, like, technological hurdles. Like, while the integration could be, like, extremely difficult, those are kind of some of the novel or kind of the most flashy parts of the rocket. And you could say the most critical. Yeah. I'm sure it will be a beast to get everything integrated, but we're definitely planning very strongly for that. And
So yeah, on that note, we're planning for 2017 suborbital flight. And also, as far as like putting the entire vehicle together, we are, when we're designing this, keeping manufacturing in mind. And in my experience, and even from school projects, I was very heavily involved in school projects as well as New Space. A lot of the design and engineering, we can tend to, you know, come up with these great ideas, but not think about how we're going to put it together. And everyone here has really taken the approach of, can you get a wrench in there? Can you figure it out? Can you put it together? What happens if this doesn't work? We're really thinking about the integration as a part of the design right now.
Yeah, we're fortunate to have a lot of experience on the team. People who have done, you know, exactly this kind of thing before at various new space companies. And, so they've been there and done that, and they know the hurdles that we're going to have to dodge. And so sometimes they'll scream and wave their hands in a meeting, you know, particularly like the technicians maybe, you know, might be in an engineer's meeting and say, hey, wait a minute, you guys, you can't build that. Like, there's no way we can put that together kind of thing. So.
And are you guys looking at doing as much in-house manufacturing as you can, or are you looking for manufacturing partners, or have you already set that up? How's that working?
I mean, to start off, we're definitely working with a lot of partners, or partners and contractors, which can really spur along our development, especially as far as facilities and those sorts of things. Ultimately, we would like to bring as much as possible in-house. And again, getting back to that, like that vertical integration, meaning from a company organizational standpoint, not from adding the payload to the rocket. Yes. but absolutely, we're trying to have as much in-house expertise and build that up as much as possible.
And one of the best things about what we're doing here is we're actually going to have our manufacturing facility in Briggs, Texas, where we have our test facility. So we can manufacture, pump these out, have just a really short rollout to start testing them, roll them back in. There's no huge shipping that we're going to have to incur. That's one of the best parts about Texas. And that's located 30 minutes north of us in Austin. So we're all very close and near each other.
And we're all out there on the weekends, hammer nails and building test stands. So we're involved at every step as well.
Boy, that sounds awfully Kerbal.
Yeah.
It's fun. Yeah.
It's actually quite fun. You can, as an engineer, you can sit there and get caught up in your head and just behind a computer. And a lot of us actually enjoy our time out there building stuff.
Yeah, very, very enriching part of the job is being involved in every aspect like that.
Yeah, that's really awesome.
So one last question from one of our Reddit subscribers. I don't know how to say his name. Wagig? I don't know.
I actually asked him about this.
Okay, you did.
So it's WA as in Washington, GI, like it's his location. So it's like something peninsula. So he said you can pronounce it however you want, so... Wagaikpen?
Sure. You know who you are. Okay, so the question was, how well characterized is the FRE2 engine at altitude? Now, since you've never flown it, obviously, but I'm sure you can do all kinds of tests. He didn't put much more to the question than that.
Yeah, I actually rephrased his question a bit. Yeah, so, you know, I think the big problem is that aerospikes are really great low in the atmosphere, but once you start getting up higher, you know, they're not as great, which is why you guys have switched over to why your vehicle will then switch over magically to a conventional bell on the second stage. So what Wagaikpen, wow, that's fun, was asking about was how well do you guys, understand your FRE2 performance when you start getting up into the zone where it's, you know, only questionably better than having a conventional bell?
Yeah, it's a good question. We're doing a few things to characterize aerospike performance. One is we're working with a guy who's just basically sort of a, from my perspective, sort of the godfather of aerospikes, because I'll be reading various literature papers, and saying, oh, I got to show this one to him. And then I'll look up at the top and he's the author of it. And I think, oh, okay, whoops. All right. and so we've got some great industry experience, you know, going back even to like sort of the 70s when this research was starting to get underway. So we've got that kind of heritage to look back on and sort of sanity check our performance expectations. But also, you know, we've got, as I said, I guess literature data, but also CFD, again, computational fluid dynamics, where you can then see how your configuration compares to what you expect according to literature data. So, and then as a further verification of the CFD, you can of course put it on the test stand, see if your sea level performance, is comparable. And, you know, once you can anchor your performance at one point and get a good idea of it at sea level, say, then you've got at least a decent idea of how the CF will change, as you go through the atmosphere. So we're doing sort of 1D calculations, with literature data and with, the historical experience that we have. And then also CFD, you know, 3D simulations, and finally we'll be putting them on the test stand. So
yeah, just in general, we've been, I feel like at least, very fortunate to come across a bunch of people that are very knowledgeable and willing to help us. The same thing funnily happened today. One of our payload engineers was looking at fairing optimization, and our aerodynamicist was actually the the author of it, and he's like, well, I guess I'm going to the right person. So we've been very lucky so far, having great resources.
One of the papers? Yeah.
Yeah, Mike.
And really choosing to work with kind of the best and the brightest in the industry. And like, yeah.
And Tom's just amazing, not to suck up to him, but he's really cool to work for, because he'll just go to a whiteboard and just go to town designing something with you. And it's very collaborative. No one's ever held back, and best idea wins.
Yeah, that's Tom Markuzic, by the way, our CEO.
The one that pays our bills.
He should get a mention in there somewhere.
So instead of asking you guys, where can we find you on the internet, we like to ask, where would you like to be found on the internet? So obviously fireflyspace.com is where we can find the company. Would you guys like to, you know, announce your individual Twitters or anything? That's fine.
If you check out the Firefly website, Tom sporadically posts a blog that he's supposed to write about what it's like starting your own rocket company. That needs to be updated, but we also have a Twitter, Firefly Space Twitter. I'm sure everyone's seen it.
And also a Facebook and a LinkedIn. Like, I think you can find us all through that, like, relatively easily.
Okay. Then our now traditional final question.
No pressure.
If each of you got a chance to fly to space recreationally, what's one item you'd like to bring with you?
I was gonna say, like, if I had a dog, I'd pick my dog, but, like, I don't have a dog, so I can't do that.
Would you really want to bring an animal to space, though?
I feel like that'd be kind of cruel, but I like dogs, but I wouldn't actually do that.
I think you could bring a bird. I think the bird would be just fine.
Forrest would bring a cat. Now, that's what Forrest would do.
I'd bring propellant for the journey home.
And I always like the videos of the astronauts eating M&Ms, so I'd bring a lot of M&Ms.
That's a good answer.
There's so many ways I can answer this question. Like, that's the difficult part.
That's the fun part.
I'd probably, if I could actually use my iPhone in space, which I know sounds so millennial of me, I'm very close with my parents, so I'd want to, like, call them from space and not have them have to go to the range or Houston to talk to me. So I'd want to be able to call them from space. Shout out to my parents.
I'm not sure it would work, though.
But it wouldn't work, so.
And I could certainly give you many nerdy answers, too. I worked with some of the best emulsion polymer guys back in school, and they carried out some of the first examples of heterogeneous catalysis experiments in space, making wonderfully small, wonderfully monodisperse particles of various sorts.
So basically, you want to be Don Pettit.
What?
You want to be Don Pettit.
He's an astronaut.
He's an astronaut who, that's what he did with his spare time. He brought up goop and mixed goop and, you know, tried to get, you know, really thin film sheets of water and see what happened when he bounced things off of it. And
all the cell biology side of it, too, like watching how cells and tissue evolves in the absence of gravity. Like, that's all, like, really, really interesting. And I know they're already learning a lot, but I have a little bit of background in that too, so it'd be fun to learn it firsthand.
I think he made himself cry in space once, which looked really painful to watch. Just so you could watch the fluid build up on his eyes. It doesn't go anywhere, obviously. It just, you know, collects. It's, look horrible. Okay, so did you all get your answers in? Because I know you were all just going back and forth. I guess that's good enough. So you guys got to get going, but we very much appreciate you coming on. This has been a lot of fun. Maybe one day in the future we can have you back on.
Check back in a year. I guarantee that we're going to be so much further along. When we started, we didn't even have a test site. Now we're 90% complete with that, so.
And also, in the next couple of months, we'll be releasing our payload user's guide, which should be a should be a fun read and give a lot more specifics.
Riveting.
Yeah, we will definitely try to check back with you in a year, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks a lot, David.
Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
All right, well, let's talk about the upcoming spaceflight events brought to you by twitter.com/nextlaunch.
Okay, so we got a tweet this week that made me slap my forehead because I should have thought of this earlier. James Sutherland, right? James Sutherland on Twitter. His Twitter handle is jsutherl, J-S-U-T-H-E-R-L, told us, hey, you guys, don't say the date first. Say the mission first. Because he said that he would listen and he would hear, oh, there's a SpaceX mission coming up, and then he'd have to rewind to hear the date and the time. Totally. We're happy to do that. And I don't know why we didn't think about that earlier. So, hey, guess what? A SpaceX launch is coming up. Falcon 9 version 1.1 carrying a CRS-7 is flying on June 28th at 1421 hours UTC. That's also 1021 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Look forward to the grappling 5 p.m. and the berthing at 8:30 p.m. Eastern time.
So June 28th, if you're into SpaceX launches. Next one, we have a Soyuz Progress mission, M28M. That's going to be that will be webcast at NASA.gov. That will be taking place on July 3rd at 12:55 in the morning Eastern Daylight Time. The docking will happen at 2 a.m. on July 5th, so that's 2 days later. So
2 days later.
Yeah, one of those. What do they call that? Oh crap! What's it called when you?
It's like the 42 orbit rendezvous or something like that. Then an Ariane 5 ECA is going to be flying Star 1 C4 and MSG 4 on July 8th. Sometime. We don't know. They will be doing a webcast, but we don't know what time yet. And this is the fourth of the ones that they've put up. So they've got multiple copies up there just for redundancy. Apparently they're in the same orbit.
And that's on July 8th. So remember, July 8th. If you're in French Guiana or you just want to watch it on the internet.
If you're in French Guiana, you cannot forget about it because you will hear it.
Yeah, it's a small little territory. So, all right, well, that takes care of today's show, I think. Let's do over the show. But before we do that, let's talk about some responses we had on iTunes. We have two listeners who wrote in. They were very kind. They gave us whatever it is, 4 or 5 stars.
5 stars.
5 stars, yes.
Yeah, so JT, and JT also pointed out that we should call Earth Sol 3 or Sol C, which I'm fine with. Also, thanks to Jungle Jim. If you like this episode, please review us on iTunes and Stitcher.
Sorry, his iTunes handle is Jungle Tim. Or, I'm sorry, Jungle. Yeah, Jungle Tim, but you said Jungle Jim.
Oh, did I say Jungle
Jim? Yeah.
Thanks, Jungle Tim.
Thank you very much, Jungle Tim. All right, let's cue the music, all of which is brought to you by Ronald Jenkies. As always, check him out at ronaldjenkies.com.
You can connect with us on Twitter and Reddit at Orbital Podcast.
Or you can send questions and comments to info@theorbitalmechanics.com.
For more information on this episode, such as show notes and other links, visit our website at theorbitalmechanics.com.
So we will see you in 2 weeks once again on orbit. Till then, bye.
Goodbye, everybody.
All right, cool. Yes, thank you very much. I have to clear my throat now. Thank you very much. Crap. Hold on, let me drink something. All right. Thank you very much.